the year.
Recreating notable events of passing time, reviving memories of men and women who have contributed to the history of a modern world. That was the year.
Southfallen, England, March 28th.
For the first time in the history of man, the spark gap of wireless telegraphy spits out a message in Morse code over a distance of 32 miles from Bologna, France, to the county of Kent. 26-year-old Italian inventor Guglielmo Marconi takes one more step toward perfection in this infant medium of communication.
1899. That was the year.
In Denver, Colorado, there came to a grim finale one of the most picturesquely boisterous lives ever to rise from the blatant cacophony of the ribald West. At the muddy intersection of Harrison Avenue and Chestnut Street, in the bawdy mining town of Leadville, two seedy, bearded men stand amid the debris of the previous night's debauch. It is Sunday morning, April 21, 1878.
Well, should we try it?
Yeah, come on.
There he is, sorting out the mail yet. Come on.
Oh, hello, boys. What can I do for you?
Mr. Tabor, my name is August Ritchie.
Yeah?
This is my partner, Theodore Hope.
Ah, how are you? How are you?
Mr. Tabor, we have found the mine that we sure is going to be sehr good.
Yeah, on Friars Hill. The new discovery, sir.
Yeah, well.
Mr. Deber, we have no money. We got to get the grub stake.
Yeah. Will you stake us, Mr. Tabor?
Why, sure, boys. What'll you have?
Oh, right.
Come on over here. We'll pick up.
Thank you.
With characteristic gusto, Leadville's mayor, postmaster, treasurer, storekeeper help the down at the heel prospectors choose their food and equipment. Then...
Well, boys, that amounts to $64.75, right?
Yes, sir. That's
all right, I'll just put it down here in my book. Yeah, 75 cents. There you are. Now, you sign right below.
Thank you. Yeah. August, now you.
Yeah.
That's it. Now, I'll get a third of whatever you dig out, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
All right, boys, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Oh.
Oh, hello, Augusta. I didn't see you standing there.
Oh, what have you done now?
Oh, I just gave...
You just gave away another $64.75 worth of goods to a couple of no-good, worthless tramps.
Oh, now, Augusta, those boys have got votes, just the same as anybody else in Leadville. Augusta, I'm mayor of Leadville. I'm in politics now, honey. I've got to be a good fellow. Why, $65. Well, what's that?
What's that? Oh, Hall, why do you keep this up? You and Maxie and I will be eating bacon rind before the month is out if you don't quit staking every tramp that comes along. You mark my words. We're heading for the poorhouse.
But on the second day of May, the door of Tabor's store again bursts open.
Mr. Tabor!
Huh? Oh, hello, boys. Well, I never expected...
No, you never expected we would ever come back yet, huh? Now, look at this, Mr. Tabor. Look.
$800, Mr. Tabor. $800. And one third of it is yours.
$800. $800. Augusta! Augusta! Come in here! We're rich!
And Horace Austin Warner Tabor, Hall Tabor to his family and friends, was started on the most spectacular career of fortune building and fortune spending the West had ever known. 3 months later, the newly christened Little Pittsburgh mine was putting out $20,000 worth of silver ore every week, and one third of it was Haw Tabor's. Later, Tabor bought what soon turned out to be a salted claim. Tabor laughed, told the workmen as long as he'd been sucker enough to buy it, they might as well keep on digging. 30 feet down, they struck a vein of silver, which made the Little Pittsburgh look like a piker. The Tabor fortune was mounting by the day, the hour, the minute.
Haw Tabor becomes Lieutenant Governor of Colorado.
Haw Tabor builds the tallest, most ornate building between Chicago and California.
Haw Tabor gives to Denver the $1 million Tabor Grand Opera House.
Haw Tabor entertains ex-President U.S. Grant and President-to-be Benjamin Harrison.
In the meantime, Tabor met Elizabeth McCord Doe, blonde, voluptuous wife of a Central City miner, persuaded her to divorce her husband, set her up in a palatial suite in Denver's Windsor Hotel. Finally, deserting his own wife, Augusta, the woman who had risen with him from obscurity and poverty, Tabor, through his right-hand man, Billy Bush, convinced her he was through with her, settled $250,000 cash and some property on her when she agreed to divorce him. Appointed to fill a vacancy in the U.S. Senate for 30 days, Tabor married Baby Doe in Washington, D.C., attended by foreign diplomats and the nation's chief executive, President Arthur. It was estimated that Senator Tabor's 30-day tenure of office in the country's highest council cost him $10,000 a day. But Haw Tabor didn't mind. He didn't care how much it cost him. He didn't know exactly how vast was his fortune. but he did know his income from the matchless and other mining interests was more than $80,000 a month. Then one day in 1890, after the birth of a second daughter to baby Doe Tabor, a young man is ushered into the presence of this Midas of the West.
Come in, young fella. Sit down.
Thank you.
So you're Bill Bran of Nebraska, huh?
That's correct, Mr. Tabor.
Yeah. Well, what did you have to drink? Champagne, highball, or cocktail?
Oh, nothing, thank you, sir. Well, I've never tasted anything stronger than grape juice in my life.
What? Well, I'm going to have a drink. You go ahead and talk, Bill.
Mr. Tabor, I've come to you because you're the strongest and most powerful silver man in the West.
Yeah, that's right. Go ahead.
Mr. Tabor, do you know what the gold interests of the East are going to do?
What?
They're getting ready for a fight to the finish on the free coinage of silver. Grover Cleveland is going to be the Republican candidate for president. And if he's elected, well, the bottom will drop out of silver.
Oh, go on. Say, hey, there's enough silver left in Colorado to build a 40-foot wall around the state. Hey, say, if those Wall Street maggots want to butt their head against that, let them go ahead and try. Come on, Bill. You better have a drink.
But the prophecy of 30-year-old William Jennings Bryan proved tragically true. Cleveland was elected. The Sherman Silver Act was repealed. The bottom did drop out of silver. Haw Tabor's empire crashed about his head, struck by the lightning bolt of an act of Congress. Gone was the Tabor block. Gone was the Tabor Grand Opera House. Gone were his holdings in Texas, Colorado, and Honduras. The only vestige of the Tabor opulence was the now virtually worthless, matchless mine, filled with water that rotted its timber, rusted its machinery. The Tabors went to live in a small side street cottage for which they paid $30 a month, subsisted on dry bread and soup bones. Years of the old poverty returned. Until in 1897, through the assistance of Winfield Scott Stratton, now a multimillionaire gold mine owner, Tabor received the appointment of postmaster of Denver at a yearly salary of $3,500. Postmaster of the post office on a site which he, Haw Tabor, had presented to the government. Postmaster at a salary the amount of which he had lost innumerable times in a single hand of poker. Then one day in April 1899, as Denver's stoop, graying 68-year-old postmaster mounted the government building steps after his usual noon stroll.
Hello, Senator.
Hmm? Oh, hello there.
Fine day, isn't it?
Oh, you bet. And more to come. We ain't seen the beginning of prosperity here in Denver.
Senator, what's the trouble? Are you sick?
Yeah. It's awful pain. Here, take me home.
At the Windsor Hotel, doctors pronounced the sudden attack intestinal inflammation. Today, they would diagnose it appendicitis. A few days later, peritonitis developed, and Haw Tabor, his head resting in Baby Doe's lap, knew the end was near.
Baby, are you there?
Yes, Haw. I'm here.
Take care of Pearl, Silver Dollar, and Baby, keep your hands onto the matchless. Don't give it up.
I won't. I'll keep a hold of it.
This is the happiest day of my life.
And Horace Austin Warner Tabor died, penniless, broken, but joyous in his memories. Those who attended the next performance at the Tabor Grand Opera House saw through the mists of its fading glory the inscription upon the hand-painted asbestos curtain.
So fleet the works of man, back to the earth again. Ancient and holy things fade like a dream.
1899, that was the year.
That at the suggestion of the Emperor of all the Russias and at the invitation of the Netherlands government, representatives of 26 nations met for the first time at The Hague, Holland, to discuss ideas on how not to make war.
That was the year.
There died in the U.S. two peculiarly contrasting figures in the fields of letters and religion.
At Dobbs Ferry, New York, July 21, Robert Green Ingersoll, aged 66, Civil War veteran, politician, and religious agnostic.
At Northfield, Massachusetts, December 22, Dwight Lyman Moody, aged 62, evangelist, writer of hymns, founder of Christian schools, author of The Way to God and How to Find It.
1899. That was the year.
That the widening breach between the Dutch Boers in South Africa and the English Uitlanders finally resulted in the inevitable climax.
The Transvaal government will offer a franchise after 5 years' residence if the English government will abandon claims of suzerainty.
Her Majesty's government,
refuses to abandon its claims of suzerainty over the Transvaal.
The Transvaal government withdraws its offer of a 5 years franchise.
Her Majesty's government will increase its armed force in the Natal.
The Transvaal government will resist any increase of British forces.
And the climax? War. The Boer War had begun. The war which Britons thought would comprise little more than a few skirmishes, but a war which actually lasted 3 years, with appalling loss of life.
The British lost more than 5,000 men in battle, and more than 20,000 from sickness.
The Boers lost more than 4,000 in battle.
Final terms of peace made British subjects of the rebellious Boers, gave them self-government, recognized both English and Dutch languages as official.
1899, that was the year
that this balladized love ditty was on every tongue.
Mandy Lee, I love you. Deep I do, my love.